The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the last few times that I've been here, I was away for a couple of weeks on jury duty last week and the week before teaching a retreat. I've been talking about the hindrances, what we could say the difficult energies, the energies that get in the way of our ability to see clearly, get in the way of our mind settling. So they're called the hindrances because they do tend to get in the way, to hinder our ability to settle down and to be here. The five energies are sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, and doubt. And then a couple weeks ago, I talked about sense desire. And unfortunately, that one, due to a glitch, did not get recorded. So those of you in the audio land, that's why that one wasn't there. But today I'll talk about first, I'll do a little bit of an overview, again, of the hindrances, and then talk about ill will. So these hindrances, these energies that get in the way of being present, can, when we hear that they are hindrances, we might think, I'm supposed to get rid of them. I'm supposed to not have these. But the way that mindfulness practice works isn't typically by simply trying to flip a switch to turn some mind state off. That's not really possible. Have you noticed? You know, if you're frustrated or miserable or confused or angry or irritated, to just say, gosh, this isn't useful. Maybe I shouldn't do this. We don't tend to have that kind of control over our minds, our mind states. And yet, it's not hopeless, because there's an interesting feature of mindfulness practice, and that is, if we turn our attention to difficult states of mind, turn our attention to things that are in the way of settling down, we turn our attention to sense desire, if we turn our attention to frustration or confusion or anxiety or ill will or even sleepiness or restlessness, if we turn our attention to those things and recognize, this is what's happening in the present moment, instead of being something that's in the way of our mind settling down, they become the very fodder, the very thing through which the mind can settle and connect with experience. And so when we learn how to turn our mindfulness to these experiences, they no longer function as hindrances. They're no longer in the way. They actually become the path. They actually become the way that we wake up. This has really been a huge part of my practice, the learning how not to resist and not to fight the difficult states of mind, but instead be interested in them, to get curious about them, to explore, what is this state? Oh, impatience is arising. What's this like? What's happening while impatience is happening? What can I know about this? So much transformation happens by being willing to observe these states of mind. The very act of turning towards a difficult state of mind. Well, there's a couple things that happen. One is that it takes the energy out of the kind of the reactive cycle. So, for instance, with ill will, since we're talking primarily about ill will today, I'll use ill will as an example. In ill will, when ill will is happening, generally there's something happening that we are reacting to. Perhaps something in the world, something somebody said, something somebody did, something we've seen, an idea that's been put out there. There's something out in the world that is happening and we don't like it. Or there's something out in the world happening and we think it's in the way of something that we want to do. And so there's this reaction to something that's happening in the world, and this response of ill will arises. If we keep our attention on the reason why we think we're angry, if we keep our attention on the person or the thing or the situation that is that we are reacting to, then the cycle of reactivity tends to continue. And so this is not what is meant by being aware of, being mindful of the state of mind. The movement is to turn the attention, being mindful, to turn the attention away from the cause, or the, not the, let's not use the word cause, away from the reason in the world why we're reacting, and to the experience of the reactivity itself. What does it feel like to be a human being that's impatient or angry or enraged? What does it feel like? What is that experience? So we take our attention out of the thing that's kind of fueling. We take our attention out of the thing that we are reacting to and turn the attention to the experience of the reactivity itself. And this, first of all, it supports us not being in touch with the thing that's starting this, that makes the cycle happen. It makes us be reactive, and it also tends to help us to decouple ourselves from the thoughts around the situation. So there's something happening, and very often the gas pedal on ill will is that shouldn't be happening. Thoughts around it. They shouldn't be doing that. This is why they shouldn't be doing that. I should tell them this. They need to stop. This is so the mind goes into thinking, and that thinking itself is like the gas pedal, the foot on the gas pedal that just feeds the feeling, feeds the reactivity. And so turning our mindful attention to the experience of reactivity takes our foot off the gas pedal, essentially. Takes the foot off the gas pedal. Now let's use this analogy a little bit longer here, the analogy of the gas pedal and the, so let's just imagine we're in a car going 65 miles an hour on the freeway. If we take our foot off the gas pedal, the car doesn't come to a stop, right? It continues to roll, but we know that it will come to a stop because we're no longer fueling, we're no longer giving it fuel. And so very similarly with the mindfulness, when we turn our attention to the experience of reactivity, experience of any of the hindrances, when we turn our attention to the experience of any of the hindrances and take our foot off of the fuel for that, it doesn't mean that suddenly that state of mind stops. The experience of anger or frustration or impatience or annoyance will continue for a little while. But because we're no longer fueling it, it can slowly kind of wind itself down and come to a stop. And in the process, we learn a lot about what puts that together and what the experience of that reactivity is. And so one of the best learnings that we have around reactivity, when we take our attention out of the situation and out of our thoughts, because our thoughts are often convincing us that this reactivity is going to help us be happy, Our thoughts are convincing us, yes, if I just get this fixed, then everything's going to be okay. And so because of that, because we're believing the world of our thoughts, we're believing the story our thoughts telling us around, yes, if I can just fix this, if I can just get rid of this, if I can just get myself out of here, all of these movements around ill will, then I'll be happy. I'll be okay. Maybe not happy, but I'll be okay. And so when we're caught in that belief or that story, when we believe the story that if I get rid of this thing or if I follow through on this anger, somehow I'll be happy, then we don't actually notice so much just how much the state of the reactivity itself is already making us feel really bad right here in the present moment. It's as if our thinking, yes, I'll fix that. You know, the idea of being in control has a pleasant feeling. There's a pleasantness to the feeling of being in control. And so when we're in that world of the thought that says, yes, I'm going to fix this, it's like masking or obscuring just how unpleasant and unhelpful the state of the contractedness, the impatience, the reactivity actually is. And so when we take our attention out of the situation and turn towards the experience itself, we get the lesson that the actual state of impatience or anger or ill will or desire or restlessness, the actual state has an agitating quality to itself. And so the mind begins to learn, the mind begins to get some different information about this experience. It gets the information that this state itself is not conducive to well-being in the present moment. So it's as if our minds are telling us, and very often this is the case, it's kind of like, well, it's telling us, well, I will give up the well-being, sense of well-being here and now for the possibility that maybe sometime in the future I'll have well-being. And so the mindfulness begins to give us the information that the reactivity itself is already not well-being. And because it starts to get that information, the way that mindfulness works is that as we turn our attention to reactivity, as we become mindful of it, it creates the conditions for those reactive states to weaken. Because as our mind understands that this state of anger, confusion, irritation is not itself in the moment well-being, the mind begins to recognize this isn't so helpful. And it heads in the direction of letting go. It heads in the direction of releasing that. And so mindfulness of reactivity tends to create the conditions for reactivity in the present moment to diminish. Mindfulness of beautiful states of mind, such as happiness, compassion, confidence, concentration, mindfulness itself, balance of mind, ease of mind. When we turn our attention to that, the mindfulness points out, yes, this is in the direction of well-being. And so it gravitates in that direction. And so mindfulness simultaneously creates the conditions for the weakening of the challenging, difficult states and the supporting of the wholesome, supportive states. And so turning our attention to these hindrances actually is doing both of those things simultaneously. We are simultaneously aware of the difficult state and cultivating the wholesome state of mindfulness. And possibly even at the same time, you know, what I've seen happen as I learn more and more skillfully how to be with these difficult states of mind, Yesterday I was practicing with this as I was driving. I was noticing some impatience as I was behind a slow car. So I was noticing the feeling of impatience and recognized the kind of the tension, and actually part of what led me to talk about this in the guided meditation, that impatience kind of came out in the face. And so I noticed that. I noticed the feeling of the impatience and noticed that it was expressing itself physically. And so I recognized, well, I can't just flip the switch on the impatience. But this expression on my face, I have some choice about that. So I relaxed my face and felt kind of this sense of ease and peace wash through me, even as there was still a little bit of impatience. And so simultaneously, the mindfulness can allow a space of ease, of delight, even of joy, while watching something that can be challenging. And so both sides can be cultivated as we turn our attention to these challenging states. So more specifically, so that's more generally on just why it's helpful to be mindful of the hindrances, with a few examples around ill will. And now I'd like to talk a little more in detail around ill will. So ill will is that state of mind that basically has the perspective that there's something wrong in the world, and my happiness, something either wrong in the world or with me. I've often noticed that I have ill will about things happening in my own heart and mind. So something's wrong and I don't like it. That in order for myself to be happy, the belief around ill will is in order to be happy, that thing needs to change. That thing needs to go away, or I need to get myself out of here. So the movement of ill will is either kind of an active outward pushing away, get rid of something, control it, fix it, or a kind of remove yourself, kind of withdrawal, either, you know, fear or just fleeing. Could also be depression, could also have a sense of shutting down, trying to shut down around something. So the ill will has the sense that our happiness depends on changing something, or changing myself, or changing, getting myself out of the situation. So we think that the problem, as I said earlier, lies out there, that we need to control or fix or change. Now, I always have to say this because there are definitely things in this world that are unjust, that are, you know, not things that we should... sign up to, let continue to happen if we have any say over the matter. You know, example might be a person in a situation of being abused. You know, that there's harm being created in a situation, and very often there is a sense of, you know, a feeling of anger around that situation or ill will around either the situation or the perpetrators of the situation. And so what I'm not saying is that you should simply say, oh, okay, ill will is happening. I should just notice the ill will and, you know, not do anything here. If there's a situation of injustice or danger, physical danger, or you know, harm, either psychological or physical harm, then it's skillful to get yourself out of that situation or try to do something to change the situation. The motivation for that action, to get yourself out of the situation or to change the situation, does not have to include ill will. It, in the process that we undergo and the process of transformation that we work with, it's very likely that there will be some ill will present if you are having to take action. And yet what we can possibly do there is to recognize, yes, there is ill will here. Know clearly, yes, there is ill will here. Know that it is a reactive emotion. Have the understanding that it might be possible to act without that, but take the action. See if you can stop the situation, get yourself out of the situation. Sometimes I suggest, you know, just checking in and seeing, is there any way in which there can be an alternative motivation for the action? For instance, in an abusive situation, rather than having the motivation be anger against the other person to get yourself out of there, why not compassion for yourself to get yourself out of there? Compassion for the suffering that you're experiencing, and that doesn't have to continue. And so the exploration, and just to explore the possibility that, you know, so much of our action in the world is motivated by a kind of a harsh quality, either the quality of ill will, of aversion, or the quality of desire, of greed. And it's not necessary. When there is something that needs acting on in the world, wisdom can motivate, compassion can motivate, joy can motivate, love can motivate, generosity can motivate. Not acting out of reactivity doesn't mean that we just are blobs in the world, not moving and acting in the world. But it does encourage us, this teaching around the hindrances and around, I think, ill will in particular, encourages us to look at our motivations for our actions and see, is it possible to find a motivation that's more wholesome? Act out of a more wholesome motivation when we see something unjust or you know, the word wrong is not one that I like to use, but you know, something that is wrong in the world. You know, there are things that, as human beings, when we see them, there's an inner sense in our hearts that is not the way that we would like the world to be moving. And so we, you know, kind of orienting towards our inner heart compass of non-suffering, not only in our hearts but in the world, we are motivated to try to do things to change the world. And what I'm suggesting is the possibility that motivation can come from something other than ill will. And yet, you don't have to wait, especially in a situation that's dangerous. You don't have to wait until there's no ill will to act. You know, we are imperfect human beings, and so we act knowing that, yeah, I need to act here. I see that there's ill will, and yet I have to act. So we act understanding that there are consequences. Firstly, the consequences, part of it would be the consequences of not acting would be damaging. And so weighing those trade-offs. So the first thing that we need to do around ill will is really get familiar with it, get to know it, learn what it feels like. There's so many different flavors of ill will. I'll just name some. I wrote a bunch of them down. They range from subtle to really obvious. Anger, bitterness, resentment, hostility, dislike, rage, irritation, annoyance, worry, hatred, distrust, cruelty, discontent, frustration, aversion, dissatisfaction, contempt, disdain. Sometimes impatience is a quality has a quality of aversion. Sometimes it has a quality of greed. We're impatient to get something we want. Sometimes it has a quality of impatience to get rid of something we don't want. Fear can be considered a flavor of ill will. Apprehension can be considered a flavor of ill will. Anxiety might be considered a flavor of ill will. A feeling of wanting to control can be a flavor of ill will. So learning to recognize these states and recognize, this is happening, you know, that sense of turning towards. Sometimes we can actually use the thoughts as a way to help us recognize what's going on. So getting to know the stories or the familiar habits or patterns of mind around some of these states. So, you know, the mind state of aversion is this is the basic form of ill will. It's just like, not this, I don't like this, I want to get rid of this, how can I get rid of this? That's kind of the basic aversion. And so those kinds of thoughts might be running in the mind. How can I get rid of this? I don't like this. Fear can be, you know, fear can have a reaction to something right in the present moment. You know, fear might be that you're standing in front of a rattlesnake that's coiled, and, you know, there's this experience of fear. That kind of fear, in my experience, is not particularly a hindrance to being present. It actually, like, you're right there. And, I actually had this happen at Spirit Rock one day. I was walking up a path, and there was this, it was a baby, you know, it was kind of dusk, and there was this little, I thought it was a crack in the sidewalk, and I took a step near it, and it coiled and rattled at me, and boy, I froze, and I noticed, wow, you know, there's fear. And I just, you know, I just watched what the body did, you know, I was experiencing that fear, and the body slowly took a few steps backwards. Now, this was just the response in the present moment to that experience of fear. And rather than thinking about it or trying to decide, oh, what should I do? It's like I just was there in the present moment and the body kind of knew what to do. So that's not the kind of fear I'm talking about. The kind of fear that tends to be a hindrance tends to be the fear that is based on an idea of something that might happen. It's a construct of this thing in the future might happen. So often the fear that is a hindrance has a what if story to it. What if this happens? What if that happens? This can be connected to anxiety as well. So what if this bad thing happens? It's got a quality of projecting into the future. Irritation, annoyance, probably has the story something like, they shouldn't have done that if it's around people, or this thing shouldn't be here. Again, what's the story around irritation? Anger. Somebody, what's the story around anger? Just say it and I'll repeat it. What's the story around anger? There's several I could think of. How could they do that? Any others? You done me wrong is the kind of that one. Another one I came up with is, I'm right, you're wrong. So the feeling of self-righteousness, that I'm right, that's often a story, you know. Impatience. What's the story around impatience? Hurry up. That's a good one. Uh-huh. Anyone else? Think of different ways you experience impatience.
That if this doesn't happen in a timely fashion, i.e. on my schedule.
Okay, so if...
I will be embarrassed. Things will not work out the way...
Okay, yep. So the mind is in a kind of a story around if this doesn't happen in a timely fashion. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
find that at the root of it, there's a lot of, I'm going to look bad.
I'm going to look, so a lot of I'm going to look bad. That has got a lot to do with, that's a kind of a deeper level of hindrance in a way that fuels other layers of hindrances on top of it. So that's great to see that at the root of it is this, I'm going to look bad. You know,
this is disempowering.
This is disempowering, another story around impatience, yeah. The one that for me I noticed was, because I did an exploration of impatience for a period of time, a couple of months, because I noticed it was a predominant state in my experience. It happened a lot. And this is something I encourage of all of you. You know, it's like if you notice that there's particular flavors of hindrances that happen to you a lot, pick one of them and give it a study for a few months. And so I did this with impatience. You know, I decided, okay, I'm going to study impatience for a while. And, you know, I noticed at first I was noticing the obvious forms of impatience, like being caught in the traffic and that hurry-up feeling and that kind of thing. But then I began noticing it happened like, oh my gosh, it was like everywhere. I would be brushing my teeth and feeling impatient. And the story there was, this isn't worth my time. And I had to laugh when I actually saw that story around brushing my teeth. It's like, really? This isn't worth my time? You know, it's like, think about what would happen if you didn't brush your teeth. You know, just the mind creates its stories around, you know, I've got better things to do than brush my teeth. So that I've got better things to do than sometimes is a story around impatience. That's a great one to see. It is. So I'll just repeat that for the tape that she saw in seeing and looking at impatience and studying impatience, she saw that somehow she thought the future was more important than now. That is a huge insight because, you know, it's like we are giving up the now for some, like, fantasy, basically. An idea of what the future might be versus a cultivation or an exploration of, well, right now is all there is. How might it be possible to let this be the most important thing to be with? So that's a beautiful insight. I mean, it is shocking. And insights have that tendency to be kind of mind-blowing. It's like, yeah, it's surprising when we see what our minds are actually doing. So that's a great recognition. So getting familiar, first of all, beginning to recognize, okay, yes, this is ill will. And just starting to get familiar with it. Then starting to say, okay, how can I be mindful of this? You know, in daily life, this practice, it takes a little bit of time to get to the place where it's possible to allow the mindfulness to kind of track what's going on. You know, that it's possible to be engaged in an activity and being mindful at the same time. It is possible, but it takes quite a bit of practice to get there. And so, you know, when you notice in daily life an experience of anger, you know, you might be in a conversation with somebody, having a challenging conversation with a coworker, for instance. And, you know, it's like you're not going to just say, like, stop, okay, I need to, like, turn my attention to my body and pay attention inside. You know, you're not going to be able to just stop things in order to turn attention in. And so you just do the best you can. Just even being aware, wow, oh, there's anger right here. Oh, there's anger here. Even that has a power to it. Just knowing it has a power to it. Even if you can't, stop the situation or redirect what's going on, even just knowing, this is happening, can be powerful. One tool that I'm starting to play with more now in my daily life, I just kind of articulated it to myself yesterday. I've been doing it for a while, but I articulated what it was, and that is, okay, there's something arising here in the present moment. I probably can't just flip the switch. I know I can't just flip the switch and have that difficult state of mind go away. But what is happening in the present moment that I do have some say over? So I noticed this at the gym. I was at the gym yesterday. This is the first place I recalled this, that, you know, the gym is one of those places where I have impatience. It's one of those things. I've got other things I'd rather be doing. So I'd rather be doing is another story around impatience. And so that was going on. And I noticed that there was a way in which the face had a kind of an expression on it, a kind of a, you know, just, it was subtle, but there was a tension or contraction in the face. There was a way in which my movements, even though they were pretty slow, I was doing stretching at the time. I was nearly done and was doing stretching. The movements were, you know, just a little bit faster than they needed to be. And so I, recognizing the impatience, it's like, okay, I can't stop the impatience necessarily. Sometimes it's possible recognizing, there's impatience, that the mind just naturally begins to release it and let it go. But much of the time, like taking the foot off the gas pedal, the momentum of that state continues. But what I've started to do is to look at, well, what is happening here that I do have some say over? I have some say over how fast I move my body. I have some say over whether this expression is on my face. The quickness of the movement was kind of motivated from the impatience. Maybe if I do them faster, I'll be done faster. The expression on the face is a little bit of, you know, tension that's coming out of the mind into the face. And so if I moved my body more slowly and I allowed my face to relax, again, I noticed these were things that I had some say over in the present moment. It didn't make the impatience disappear immediately, but it did create the container in which the heart and mind softened. And again, there was this kind of two things going on. There was the mindfulness of the mind that was kind of shaky. The mind was feeling shaky. And then there was also this kind of sense of relaxing around that shakiness. The mind was no longer buying into the shakiness as being something it had to follow through on, and was just aware of it. And noticing, you know, actually it would vanish after some, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 seconds, that shakiness would go away. And then the mind would kind of be in a space of just real ease for a few minutes, and then the impatience would find its way back, and I'd do it all over again. So when you're feeling in daily life, you know, you do the best you can. Just simply even recognizing, anger's happening right now. Even that is very powerful. Just the simple recognition has a huge power. If it's possible, the next step might be not to try to stop it, but see what is, you know, maybe in a conversation, you have some say over the tone of your voice. You have some say over an expression on your face. Maybe that's possible. Not to try to suppress the feeling. This is really important in this exploration. Not to try to suppress the feeling. Unless, I mean, sometimes suppression of the feeling, actively saying, ooh, don't go there, can be helpful if you see that it's got so much momentum that there's no way to be mindful of it without, like, letting it be really messy in the world. And so sometimes it can be helpful to, like, say, okay, let's just see if we cannot go there, and not let it kind of leak out into the world. So turning towards the experience. In sitting practice, we have more opportunity to really get to know these states when they come up. You know, that if frustration arises in meditation, and it does arise, right? I mean, meditation itself will create the experience of frustration. We cannot control our minds to do what they want to do. what we want. You know, we can't simply sit down and say, okay, pay attention to the breath. I'm going to do that for 45 minutes. It's like our minds aren't that amenable to control. And so the practice of meditation itself is almost like it is going to bring up some of these hindrances. You know, frustration will come up. And so at that point, rather than like doubling down and saying, oh, time to be present with the breath, I mean, that's like following through on the frustration. Might you turn to, oh, frustration, this is what a frustration feels like. Here's how it is in the body. Here's what it does to the mind. So turning towards the experience. Really, really helpful to get familiar with mindfulness of the body, how these states of mind impact the body, because the body will often have a physical counterpart to the mental state. And just the face is one example, but the body can tense, especially with stronger versions of this, you know, with anger. You know, I found myself sometimes in such a rage that my body was just like frozen. So the body can have a correlate. And if we turn our attention to the body, the state of the body, it can really help to take us out of both the thing that we're angry about and also the stories in the mind. So mindfulness of how the body is around the emotions, very, very helpful. There's also something that's really helpful to be attuned to, and that is I know more, as we get more and more familiar with how to be present for things, so we get more able to turn towards our experience and be present for them. Subtle hindrances can find their way into the very way that we're paying attention. The most obvious form of this is feeling some experience or knowing some experience and being mindful of it in order for it to go away. Noticing, you know, a state of impatience. And, you know, we get some experience with mindfulness and we see that it's helpful. We see that, oh yeah, when I turn my attention to this, wow. You know, the first few times we do it, it's like the beginner's mind, you know. We turn to an experience and it's like, well, let's just see what this is. And it's like, wow, it starts to release and it maybe even goes away entirely. And so we see how it works. And then we start to get impatient. Like, oh, let me bring my mindfulness to this thing so that it will go away. And so in a way, you know, we bring a quality of frustration or ill will right into our mindfulness. And so it's really helpful just to check in. When you're paying attention to something, is there some hidden agenda or attitude or relationship to what we're paying attention to? So we're paying attention to a pain in the knee. You know, there's aversion to the pain. You know, if there's aversion to the pain, then, you know, following the instructions around aversion, rather than paying attention to the pain itself, because that's where the aversion is coming from, that attention to the pain, turn towards the aversion. Oh, there's pain and I don't like it. What does it feel like to not like that? There may be also fear, for instance. Oh, fear. What is fear? Now, you know, again, you know, it's not that I'm saying sit through pain. We need to have some wisdom around if a particular pain is damaging to our body. But to also notice, you know, is there some attitude in the mind? It's fine in meditation if you're experiencing pain to move. And to move mindfully. But here's a really good practice around that. Let yourself notice, first of all, the whole thing around it. So you've got this pain in your knee. First of all, notice, okay, there's the pain, and I don't like it, you know, if there's reactivity to it. So noticing the not liking, noticing perhaps other things going on, like the fear, you know, our minds can like, whoa, really like escalate around things like pain. And, you know, if we can turn to those experiences, we may actually recognize, wow, you know, actually the largest part of the unpleasantness is this, the mind that's going nuts. When I'm actually aware of that there's a pain in the knee and this whole mind, like, chaotic reactivity, I see that that pain in the knee is like, it's not very big, actually. So if you can begin to distinguish between the physical and the mental, you may discover that the reactivity is out of proportion to the physical. Maybe you'll discover that. And then you might realize, oh, well, actually, it's okay to just hang out with the fear and the aversion here. There can be times, though, when you recognize, no, actually, what's going on is the body is very clearly giving a signal, I need to move. And so if you recognize that, having noticed the fear and the not liking and the aversion, and having noticed the very clear body is giving me a warning signal, the movement could come from the compassion, the wisdom that that is a skillful thing to do, rather than right out of the reactivity. And so it's fine to move and see if there can be a connection to wisdom in that rather than reactivity. This exercise will give you a little bit of practice in what it means to be motivated from something other than reactivity. Wow, I have not gotten through half of what I was going to say. I'll say one more piece and then we'll see if there's any comments or questions. maybe. So another piece that's really, really helpful around noticing patterns of reactivity. So I mentioned that I was noticing, impatience, that I noticed a lot of impatience, that it was a pattern for me. And so when you see a particular form of ill will that's very familiar, happens a lot, sometimes we can create identities around those. It's like we congeal around those. I am an impatient person. I am an angry person. And in that, it's almost as if when we're not experiencing those states, we discount that somehow. And so one thing that's very helpful to consciously recognize, particularly with those hindrances that are strong, familiar patterns that we tend to congeal around and identify around, notice when they're not present. Notice when impatience is not present. Notice when anger is not present. Notice when frustration is not present. That conscious awareness of that begins to poke holes in the or begins to weaken the belief in that's me, that's who I am. Because, you know, if that's who I am and it's not here right now, it's like there's something wrong with that picture. So let yourself consciously recognize when some of these states are not present. What is it like for ill will to not be present? Actually, it feels pretty good when ill will is not present. What is that experience? So, comments, questions, thoughts. And use the mics for this.
Coming back to that I will look bad, when I've tried to chase that down, and then what will happen if I look bad? And coming to, well, eventually it comes down to people won't want to play with me. and that I will be alone. And I get sort of stuck there and what's so wrong with being alone. And it's like I can feel that, you know, I'm a deeply social animal, and left to my own devices at an early age would not have worked out well. And that there's, and so any thoughts on the process of chasing this stuff?
Well, so first of all, I'd like to suggest, I appreciate that you're seeing the many layers here. Some of this sounds like it's happening through reflecting, thinking about, looking at, you know, what are the thoughts here, you know, what's going on. You can actively think about these things, and that's very helpful in terms of beginning to understand some of the deeper layers. But what I'd like to suggest, the first place is, you know, you said something like, I'm going to look bad. You know, that's the kind of one of the things underneath the impatience. If this doesn't happen, then I'm going to look bad. Can you feel into what is that? What is the experience of I'm going to look bad? So that's the first, in terms of the exploration, you know, we can think through things, but the wisdom develops in the being with the layers. And so we can kind of think down layers below what we can actually be present for. And so land in the present moment with what you can be present for. Can you actually know the feeling of, I'm going to look bad? You know, what is going on there? You know, the mind is kind of agitated around that. And, you know, a lot of what's going on in I'm going to look bad, you know, what's happening there? A lot of what's going on there is thoughts. Believing thoughts.
Yes.
And those thoughts may or may not have any validity to them. And so, you know, the first place is to look at that, you know, that place. Oh, I'm going to look bad. You know, there may be a situation in which, you know, things don't go the way you'd like them to. Whether or not you look bad is an opinion, and you know that all those thoughts around I'm going to look bad. You know, some of it is like trying to control the opinions of other people. That we think happiness can come by controlling the opinions of other people, and like, you know, we can't even control our own minds, you know, much less the minds of other people. So, you know, just notice what's going on in there. You know, if I look bad, you know, then the next step down, you know, if I look bad, then I'm going to be alone. That's a huge leap. You know, that's a belief. And the truth or validity of that belief is very questionable. There may be some situations in which certain people would not want to continue a relationship or something, but that's also an assumption. And you know, there's an awful lot of flexibility that people have. So, you know, look at that level of, I'm going to look bad. Be willing to hang out there and see what happens. So, any comments?
Yeah, I think I'd rather go with the thoughts than staying in the feeling.
Indeed, you know,
that occurred to me that might be more productive.
That's the pattern, you know. That's the pattern, because we have the belief that our thoughts are going to fix the problem. You know, that we're going to think our way into solving something. And our thoughts have been incredibly helpful in this world. I mean, all of, like, science and, you know, has come from thoughts. So, yes, our thoughts have been incredibly powerful. But in terms of freeing ourselves from, and actually beginning to understand what's really going on in our minds, knowing the actual experience has no parallel. So it takes a little bit of a leap of faith to let go of the habit of I can think through this, to settle into just be with what's here. It takes a lot of patience, because it's not an instant fix. It's a much slower kind of organic settling into. So, and we need to stop. So thank you.